You are listening to an ADIS Journal podcast.
Hello, my name is Christine Besvina. I'm an associate professor at the University of Chicago, and welcome to our podcast entitled Driving Best Practices Throughout the Treatment Journey for Patients with Non-Small Cell Lung Cancer with Actionable Alterations, a podcast discussion. Today, along with my co-authors, we're going to discuss the recently expanded therapeutic landscape for patients with non-small cell lung cancer, with tumors harboring actionable alterations. We're going to look at patients with biomarker-driven treatment options. And in this podcast, our goal is to provide perspectives on how to sequence different therapeutic options, as well as different treatment algorithms, and how to specifically decide for each individual patient how to sequence these therapies. We'll try to touch on efficacy, safety, as well as patient-centric considerations. With that, I'd like to ask my co-authors to introduce themselves. Dr. Kim?
Thank you for having me. My name is Chul Kim. I'm a thoracic medical oncologist and an associate professor of medicine at Georgetown University.
Perfect. And Dr. Daboul?
Well, thank you again also for having me. Nathalie Daboul, I'm an associate professor at the Université de Sherbrooke in Canada. And I'm also a hematologist and medical oncologist specializing in thoracic oncology.
It's a pleasure to be here with you both today for this discussion. So we're going to start by providing a little bit of background on actionable alterations in advanced non-small cell lung cancer. There have been so many advances in molecular diagnostics over the past few decades that have described the genetic heterogeneity of non-small cell lung cancer, with numerous genomic driver alterations being implicated in both development as well as progression of disease. We now have a growing list of drivers that are clinically actionable, meaning that approved targeted therapies are available to inhibit these underlying mechanisms, driving oncogenesis in multiple tumor types with corresponding alterations. Dr. Kim, would you please start by outlining some of the key actionable alterations that we observe in non-small cell lung cancer?
Yeah, certainly, though there are variations based on region and patient characteristics, it is estimated that approximately 60% of adenocarcinomas and about 10% of squamous cell carcinomas harbor actionable genomic alterations. Currently, actionable alterations include EGFR mutations, BRAF V600E mutations, HER2 mutations, KRAS G12C, MET exon 14 skipping alterations, as well as fusions involving genes such as ALK, RET, and TREK, and most recently, NRG1 gene fusion joined the list. For these alterations, we have approved therapies, including tyrosine kinase inhibitors, as well as small molecules and antibody drug conjugates. So it is essential to perform molecular profiling to determine the suitable treatment options for patients.
Thanks so much. And Dr. Daboul, could you talk a little bit about what is the significance of broad biomarker testing in non-small cell lung cancer?
Broad biomarker testing is an essential part of diagnostics in non-small cell lung cancer. It is very important to have it at workup, irrespective of patient characteristics such as age, gender, or smoking history. It enables identification of candidates for targeted therapy and has become an essential part of our work. However, it's also important to mention that there are some subgroups that can be identified just by patient characteristics. For example, smoking history is more prevalent in KRAS G12C mutations.
Now that we've discussed how we think about the molecular landscape in non-small cell lung cancer, I'd like to transition to talking about therapeutic options for patients and how we sequence some of these. So historically, for patients who have non-small cell lung cancer, we had platinum-based chemotherapy as the mainstay of treatment for frontline treatment in non-small cell lung cancer. In the past decade, immunotherapy has become an essential treatment option for many of our patients in the frontline setting. Whether immunotherapy is given as single agent or in combination with chemotherapy often depends on PD-L1 expression, as well as certain physicians may choose to use combination chemoimmunotherapy even for patients who are PD-L high, depending on tumor burden or other patient characteristics. However, the treatment sequencing gets very complicated when you start to add to it some of these different actionable alterations, such as ALK rearrangements, BRAF V600E mutations, EGFR mutations, and the remainder described by my co-authors. And so now we have to make decisions about how to sequence these and what to put first. Dr. Dabul, what guidelines do you think can help practitioners make decisions in deciding how to sequence therapies for patients with actionable alterations?
Of course, there are a few guidelines that we follow depending on where we are in the world. I think for initial treatment, the NCC guidelines preferred options are matched targeted therapies that are approved for first-line use, while chemotherapy and/or immunotherapy are listed as other recommended regimens or useful in certain circumstances for some drivers. Of course, we have other guidelines. It could be the ASCO or the ESMO guidelines. And both are pretty much comfortable saying that they recommend initiating treatment with targeted agents first, in first line, rather than chemotherapy and/or immunotherapy again, for most of the alterable, actionable, I guess, genomics in non-small cell lung cancer. If we have used, for example, targeted therapy first, we know that we can sequence with chemo and/or immunotherapy depending on the situation. That said, there are some alterations that only have targeted agents in second line. For example, I can imagine that we're thinking here about KRAS G12C, with the inhibitors being approved in second line or further, and for example, ERBB2. Mutations as of now. We also have inhibitors in some part of the world that are indicated at second line therapy. And we know that these agents are moving forward in first line, and that's where clinical trials are in the moment. Of course, I think there's also sometimes patients that we discover an actionable driver while they're already on chemotherapy or chemotherapy and/or immunotherapy. And NCC guidelines have put it forward that they recommend that for many actionable alterations, we can even interrupt systemic therapy, discuss with the patient if an approved targeted therapy could be interesting for them.
That was a wonderful summary of such a quickly evolving field. I think there's no question that among these multiple driver alterations, it can get confusing about what's approved frontline, what's approved second line, where patients should receive either chemoimmunotherapy or immunotherapy up front. But I think you did a wonderful job summarizing how we can incorporate guidelines into these. Decision make it, how guidelines can be helpful for all practitioners in referencing, is this a frontline treatment option? Is this a second line treatment option? But in general, for those drugs that have approval in the frontline, we usually want to use the targeted agent first, for a number of reasons, including both efficacy and toxicity.
If I may add, this is such a changing field as well. So of course we need to go back to those guidelines very frequently as approvals do change and reimbursement and access as well.
Absolutely. As Dr. Kim, our colleague, had brought up, we've even gotten new approvals in the last 6 months for things like NRG1 fusions. And so, even for those of us who only think about lung cancer all day, every day, it's still tough to keep up sometimes. And so, it's nice for all of us to be able to have those resources as well as each other to potentially phone a friend when we need to decide when making some of these treatment decisions. So now I'd like to transition to talking about treatment sequencing for patients who have actionable alterations. Dr. Kim, can you talk a little bit more about treatment sequencing and how you make some of these decisions about how to sequence therapies for patients who have actionable alterations?
Yes, this is a topic of extensive research and perhaps some controversy. The availability of various guideline recommended treatment options really underscores the need to consider multiple factors to optimize the sequencing of treatment for patients with tumors harboring actionable alterations. One factor that may impact treatment sequencing is any delay in biomarker testing, which may lead clinicians to initiate chemotherapy and/or immunotherapy while awaiting the results, especially in patients requiring urgent symptom control. However, some studies suggest that this practice may be associated with less favorable outcomes, emphasizing the importance of initiating first-line treatment after obtaining molecular profiling data whenever feasible. Other key considerations, I would say, include relative efficacy and safety in different treatment lines, as well as patient-centric factors such as quality of life and ease of administration. Sometimes in later treatment lines, the emergence of a specific molecular resistance mechanisms may inform treatment choices, such as EGFR-T790M after first-generation EGFR-TKI therapy and EGFR-C797S after osimertinib or third-generation EGFR tyrosine kinase inhibitor therapy. Lastly, treatment sequencing decisions should also take into consideration the decreasing proportion of patients receiving therapy in each successive treatment lines, which means that patients may not ultimately receive therapies that are deferred for later use. To give you some examples, some studies estimated that approximately 30% of patients with EGFR mutant non-small cell lung cancer receive only one line of therapy, which is a number that sort of gives a lot of thoughts, and with even higher rates observed in certain oncogene-driven subtypes.
Perfect. And you referenced some of the tension that we see in clinic when the moleculars aren't back yet, and you have to make a decision about a cycle of chemotherapy versus waiting for the moleculars. It's just happened to me in clinic this week, and it took me 45 minutes to convince the patient and the family that waiting was the right thing to do. Can you speak a little bit about your experience in the clinic, and how do you talk to patients about that decision?
Yeah, this is a tough decision for some patients with a high burden of disease, and there's not a lot of time to wait for molecular profiling. Though at our center, we typically perform both tissue-based and blood-based NGS, and blood-based NGS, as you can, as we all know, comes back much faster than tissue-based NGS. So a lot of times, I wait for at least the blood-based NGS to come back before I make treatment decision. But there, I would say, rare situations where you have to start a treatment, and usually that's chemotherapy for me, because I do not want to start immunotherapy. And then one particular situation we sometimes encounter is that the molecular profiling later shows certain driver mutations such as EGFR, then you're in trouble because the sequence of IO followed by TKI sometimes can lead to different side effects. As you mentioned, I explain these points to patients, but I think this is really comes down to individual decision making, considering all the factors that the patient has, and but that there's a great tension, and this is some a certain struggle that we have.
Thanks for sharing your experience. So now let's transition to talking about something exciting, which is the efficacy of so many of these drugs. Certainly for me, this is part of why I decided to go into thoracic oncology, because the efficacy of these targeted therapies is so much better than what we have been able to historically offer our patients. Dr. Dabul, can you talk a little bit about efficacy as it relates to different actionable alterations, and also how that plays into your treatment decisions about first-line therapy?
So this is an area that I would say does not always create consensus, right? We know that efficacy for many targeted agents have been approved based on single-arm trials due to the difficulty mostly in conducting randomized trials in patients with tumors with rare alterations, and that clearly complicates treatment decision, and patients do rely on physician guidance for this. Single-arm trials, we know, lack control groups and randomization. They can result in potential bias, limited comparisons versus current standard of care treatment options. So real-world evidence data sets can help us, but of course are not as strict as, of course, comparative data. But these trials are valuable in early phase research and situations where randomized clinical trials would be either not feasible or even ethically challenging. We remember one trial that did cause a lot of discussion after being presented. That was the Libretto 431 trial, where they compared the soparcatinib, so an anti-RET medication, to a platinum-based chemotherapy with or without pembrolizumab, that showed clear superiority to the soparcatinib. However, the comparator was clearly challenged because we had already known the clear efficacy of a targeted agent in that situation, and it is well known that many targeted therapies generally result in longer progression-free survival than standard chemotherapy alone, for example.
Excellent. And let's dive into that a little bit more. Dr. Kim, can you talk about how do we, the approvals that are based on single-arm trials, how do we use this information when deciding how to sequence treatment for our patients? We're all taught always not to do cross-trial comparisons as fellows, but how do you in practice make decisions based on this information?
Right. Sometimes it's tough. In cases where these trials have included treatment naive and previous treated patients, the data have been used to support approvals for line agnostic indications. And these line agnostic approvals have sparked discussions about the optimal place for these targeted therapies within the treatment landscape, while they allow patients earlier access to new therapies and enable clinicians to tailor decisions based on the patient's disease characteristics and medical history. Approvals based on single-arm trials may leave some clinicians uncertain about how early use of these treatments compares to other standard care treatment options.
And despite the limitations that we've just discussed, do we know how effective targeted therapies will compare with chemoimmunotherapy? This is for patients who have actionable alterations. I think this is something that frequently comes up in some of the debates at different conferences. Dr. Dabul, how do you think about this space?
I think this also arises in our clinics every day. Of course, efficacy varies between different drivers and classes of targeted agents. So we always need to go back to the books, the trials, to give us a better sense of the efficacy. However, many trials of approved targeted therapies have generally shown better outcomes than are obtained with chemotherapy. We have talked about some phase threes, and I think I'll delve into that a bit more. We do have randomized control trials for some, I would say, alterable genomic alterations. But that said, soparcatinib has shown to significantly increase progression-free survival versus chemotherapy. I think what we know most is probably in the EGFR space. And the prospective evidence for immunotherapy in usually patients with tumors with actionable alterations is limited. I think it's even more the case for EGFR because we did have a few studies, including one that shows that pembrolizumab plus chemotherapy did not improve progression-free survival or overall survival, actually, versus placebo plus chemotherapy in a phase three trial for patients with EGFR mutated metastatic non-small cell lung cancer that had previously re received an appropriate targeted agent. And again, we know that immunotherapy alone in a phase two trial for that exact patient population, so EGFR mutated advanced non-small cell, really gave little benefit. These are, of course, EGFR, RET, but overall, we can say that retrospective data sets have shown modest or poor efficacy in tumors with various oncogenic drivers, and that it really encompasses ALK, BRAF, EGFR, KRAS, MET, RET, I guess many of them. And it has really highlighted that immunotherapy for these patients is not very efficacious. And they report potentially a response rate of 19%, a median PFS of not even 3 months, is, and again, a median overall survival that is poor of about a year.
Excellent. Thank you for summarizing some of the prospective data that we have in this field. I think this is also a place where we can look to real-world evidence to supplement the clinical trial data that we have. So, for an example, we have one real-world study that looked at 1,135 patients with advanced non-small cell lung cancer that had a driver alteration in a large U.S. clinical database. For patients who received the appropriate targeted therapies, they had a median overall survival of 18.6 months, compared to patients who did not receive the targeted therapy for which they were eligible, had an overall survival of 11.4 months. And so, of course, real-world evidence isn't perfect. There's many criticisms that we all could come up with. But I think when all of this data is taken together from what we have in single-arm trials, prospective randomized trials, and real-world evidence, I think, again, this is all very strongly encouraging, if not demanding, that many of these patients be treated with the appropriate targeted therapy upfront. Dr. Kim, what additional evidence can be considered when direct head-to-head comparisons are not feasible?
Yeah, sure. I think probably I can touch on two additional genomic alterations that we typically see in clinic. In the absence of head-to-head data for some targeted therapies, indirect treatment comparisons with chemo and/or immunotherapy can be insightful. For instance, matched indirect comparisons have suggested better outcomes with the MET inhibitor tepotinib compared with immunotherapy plus chemo or immunotherapy alone in the first line treatment of MET exon 14 skipping non-small cell lung cancer, which was recently presented. Another study in previously treated patients with MET exon 14 skipping positive non-small cell in the same region in region trial, outcomes with the tepotinib were better than those achieved by the same patients with the first line chemotherapy and/or immunotherapy before enrollment, as based on retrospective review. Similarly, in BRAF mutant advanced non-small cell lung cancer, dabrafenib and trametinib showed a lower risk of death and longer median overall survival compared to platinum-based chemotherapies. Acknowledging the caveats, of course, of these retrospective analyses, the data support earlier use of targeted therapy in general, especially given the limited number of treatment lines received by many patients.
Thank you. All right. So we've done a great job, I think, summarizing the efficacy data in this space. Let's now transition to safety. Dr. Kim, can you please provide an overview of the safety considerations for targeted therapies in patients who have actionable alterations in non-small cell lung cancer?
Sure. This topic could be a separate discussion on its own. Probably we need another podcast. But to highlight the key points, targeted therapies typically have a favorable safety profile with generally mild and manageable adverse events. The characteristic adverse event profiles differ between classes of targeted agents, which is not surprising. For instance, skin toxicities are associated with EGFR inhibitors, because EGFR is well expressed in certain parts of the body, including the skin, neurologic symptoms with the NTRK inhibitors, and peripheral edema with the MET inhibitors. And because of these, when we use these agents, we need to monitor and manage specific toxicities that may arise with these agents.
Perfect. And then Dr. Dubul, can you talk a little bit about how safety profiles may be affected based on sequencing therapies in this space?
So, of course, safety is always very important, as we know well. And for some targeted therapies, toxicities can be worse when a patient has received prior immunotherapy. I think the easiest example would be for patients, as Dr. Kim had mentioned, who are EGFR mutant and that have received, for example, immunotherapy first. Then we realize they are EGFR and we want to switch them to, of course, a targeted agent. And unfortunately, there are reports of quite some severe toxicities, including enhancing immune-related toxicities such as pneumonitis, colitis, and hepatitis. And similarly, in patients with KRAS G12C mutations, prior immunotherapy has been linked to an increased risk of hepatotoxicity with sotorasib treatment, even to the point that we may need to do some washout between therapies to decrease the risk of this toxicity. I think these examples may support also the earlier use of targeted therapies.
Excellent. And yeah, these provide some really challenging situations in clinic. I recently saw a patient who'd gotten osimertinib followed by chemoimmunotherapy from another provider and had CNS progression and really wanted to rechallenge her with osimertinib because of the CNS penetration of OC, and we're really limited by potential for toxicity here. So it can really become a complicated situation to make the right decision for the right patient. Next, let's try to specifically put the patient back at the center of the discussion. So, Dr. Kim, how do patient-centric considerations such as ease of administration, quality of life, influence the choice of treatment for patients with non-small cell lung cancer with actionable alterations?
Yeah, this is an important aspect to consider when we make a treatment this choice with patients. To highlight some differences, chemotherapy and immunotherapy require regular clinic visits for intravenous administration. Most targeted therapy agents are orally administered, which can increase patient convenience and may be perceived as a preferred option by some patients and their families and some providers. Clinicians and patients consider other various factors, including efficacy, dosing, convenience, cost, and adverse events when evaluating treatment options. Consistent with the efficacy, safety, and ease of administration, there's evidence to suggest that targeted therapies for non-small cell lung cancer are associated with greater improvements in quality of life and symptom relief compared to chemotherapy. And these are important factors beyond efficacy and safety to consider when we form treatment plan for patients.
And so, while there are so many advantages to using targeted therapies for patients with actionable alterations, we would be remiss to discuss some of the limitations and challenges just in setting up our listeners for some of the things they may encounter in the clinic with their patients. Dr. Dabul, can you speak a bit about some of the limitations and challenges that you've encountered and how you may have been able to overcome some of these challenges?
I think that's an important point. There are challenges and limitations in everything that we do in lung cancer. Of course, targeted therapies are not an exception. So yes, targeted therapies for patients with actionable alterations in non-small cell lung cancer are recommended. They also come with some limitation. I think the most understood limitation would be drug resistance, potential toxicity in certain patients, and the tumor heterogeneity as well, that can unfortunately reduce efficacy. But that is also something that we see in other tumor types, in other subtypes of lung cancer. And I think that really highlights the importance of continuing research to better understand what's really going on, the efficacy, safety, and even accessibility of these targeted therapies. And as we are saying, yes, we want to go first with targeted agents, and I think that's the way to go. The optimal treatment sequencing of targeted therapy with chemo and/or immunotherapy still remains an important practical consideration and something that we need to carefully look at now and in the future. I think something that we should also point out is that NGS testing or a broad panel is not done everywhere. Turnover times can be quite long. Even the precision of the test is not the same everywhere. And still, some patients undergo single gene testing only, and they may not receive results for all recommended biomarkers. which can result in a reduced chance of receiving even an appropriate targeted therapy, if any. So I think here, this discussion is also highlighting the importance of having broad biomarker testing for all patients with advanced non-small cell ca lung cancer.
Absolutely. Test, test, test. We can't treat any mutations that we don't know are there.
Absolutely.
All right. And so we're going to finish now with a few different case studies. Each of us will present a patient case where we go through perhaps some of the data, some of the toxicity that inclined us to choose a particular treatment option for a patient. Dr. Jabul, can you share your patient case with us first?
So I'll be discussing a lady that I saw at the clinic a few months ago, 75-year-old, little comorbidities that presented with, of course, non-small cell lung cancer and adenocarcinoma, where she had a lung mass, some pulmonary nodules, and small brain metastasis. She was doing well. She was ECOG 1 and had little symptoms. We had done broad testing. It took a few weeks to come back, but because she was not didn't have that many symptoms, we decided to wait for the NGS to come in. A few weeks after, we discovered that she had a MET exon 14 skipping alteration, and that she was PD-L1 low, so 1 to 49. We had a discussion then with the patient, her family, to see what was the alternatives of treatment. Of course, so access is always important, and MET exon skipping, I guess, targeted agents where I practice are available. There's only one available. It would be tepotinib. And so we discussed tepotinib first line versus a standard chemotherapy plus immunotherapy. She had no contraindications to any of those treatments. And after careful review, she preferred, and it is what we had also stressed, she had an alterable alteration. She clearly had medication that was available that was reimbursed. As we said, access is key. And we had an oral therapy to offer, so she went with tepotinib, and the treatment is ongoing right now. After 3 months of treatment, we have rescanned. Actually, everything is shrinking, so even the brain mets that were not radiated have become smaller on MRI imaging, and even on the lung nodules, everything is better. And she is it's a happy story in a way. She is doing well and continuing the medication as of today.
Excellent. Thank you for sharing that. In my own clinic, I recently had a 70-year-old female who had a moderate smoking history, 30 pack years. She had metastatic disease to bone as well as two large lung lesions, each over 3 centimeters. No brain metastasis, though, and biopsy confirmed non-small cell lung cancer adenocarcinoma with a PD-L1 of 40%, as well as a BRAF V600E mutation. And so, with this particular patient, we discussed a few different options. With her PD-L1 of 40%, we discussed chemoimmunotherapy as being her systemic treatment option. But then we also discussed encorafenib and imatinib. And so we had data from the FARAOH study that was presented at ESMO this year that, to me, was incredibly impressive from both an efficacy and a safety perspective. With encorafenib and imatinib and longer-term follow-up, we saw progression-free survival of 30 months and a duration of response of 40 months, which is really, again, really impressive in the non-small cell lung cancer era. This combination also is generally quite tolerable. And so we don't see the same amount of pyrexia that we've seen with earlier generation of BRAF-MEK inhibitor combinations. But the patients generally experience nausea, diarrhea, fatigue, vomiting, which are symptoms that in general we deal with quite frequently in our clinic, and that with some aggressive management, whether it be independently or with some assistance from our palliative care colleagues, I think we all feel pretty comfortable managing. And so we together decided to pursue encorafenib and imatinib as her frontline therapy. And similar to your patient, she's doing quite well. She's 15 months into treatment now with quite a robust response on imaging and tolerating the combination very well with just some antiemetic medication. And last but not least, Dr. Kim, please share with us your case.
My patient was a 52-year-old female who has not smoked, and she presented with abdominal girth, abdominal enlargement because of the high burden of disease in the liver. So during workup, she was found to have brain metastasis, and biopsy showed a large cell neuroendocrine carcinoma. Because of her initial symptoms, she was initiated on platinum etoposide chemotherapy while awaiting molecular profiling results at another cancer center. Upon evaluation at our cancer center, molecular profiling came back and revealed a RET fusion. The patient didn't tolerate the chemotherapy too well with the grade 3 neutropenia and other side effects. And so after mutual discussion, we decided to try selpercatinib, RET inhibitor, and she achieved a durable response both intracranially and extracranially that lasted for several years. So I think this case really highlights the importance of molecular profiling that Dr. Dabol and then and you, Christine, mentioned, the importance of comprehensive molecular testing in even non-adenocarcinoma subtype of non-small cell lung cancer, such as large cell neuroendocrine carcinoma, to guide optimal treatment selection.
Excellent. So thank you both for sharing your recent patient experiences. And so with that, we will go ahead and close out this podcast. Thank you so much to all of the listeners. As we explored the treatment journey for patients with non-small cell lung cancer with actionable alterations, I think my co-authors and co-presenters did a wonderful job covering the treatment landscape for these patients, as well as how we make clinical decisions for sequencing based off of available treatments, how we incorporate both efficacy and safety into these discussions, and how a patient-centric approach can drive decisions for how we use targeted therapies for patients with actionable genomic alterations. Thank you so much for listening.
You can listen to more podcasts by subscribing to ADIS Journal Podcasts with your preferred podcast provider or by visiting the journal website. For a full list of declarations, including funding and author disclosure statements and copyright information, please visit the article page on the journal website. The link to the article page can be found in the podcast description.